DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty in the world of science and technology. I'm Zulfi Karabani, and coming up, digital consumer rights, why you can't always return unwanted apps, and why it might not even matter if the laws are changed anyway.
It's not on the rules that there is a defective, but it's on the behavior of some big companies, especially parties like Apple, because they think they are an international business. They don't care about national rules. They only act on American-based rules.
Also on the program, new disorders hit the market with the release of the new psychiatrist Bible and Russia Online. It's a dangerous place. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, hundreds of thousands of mobile apps are downloaded and purchased every day, as you probably know. More than 50 billion apps have been downloaded from Apple's App Store, according to the company earlier this month. And Apple's closest rival, Google, also says it's approaching the 50 billion mark for downloaded apps. Sounds great, but the rising number of downloaded apps is causing some concerns, as there are no clear rules on consumer rights in this area. Are apps goods, like clothes, or are they services, or something completely different? Well, German state-level lawmakers for consumer protection have just met to discuss this problem. Our reporter Chipona Cimbulu was there to find out whether their plans to treat apps like every other product will help you and me.
The setting is idyllic, but Nauheim is one of Germany's historic spa towns, and is where consumer protection ministers from the country's 16 states got together for their annual conference. But the state of consumer rights in the mobile apps market is less than idyllic, and it's the lack of regulation for digital goods like apps that was up for discussion this year. The staggering increase in the number of apps downloaded, 50 billion in Apple's App Store alone, with its rival Google close in second place, may be something to cheer about in the tech sector, but lawmakers are concerned. Once downloaded from Apple's App Store or BlackBerry's App World, the sale is final, and there is no clear right to return an app if a user isn't happy with the product. And the Consumer Protection Minister for the state of Hesse, Lucia Potrisch, says this is something German lawmakers want to change.
We want consumers to have the right to return apps if they're unhappy with them. This is something that applies to all other products, so why shouldn't the same apply to digital goods?
A study conducted for the EU Commission suggests Europeans are losing 64 billion euros or $82 billion a year due to the lack of adequate consumer protection rules for online products like apps, software, and music. With most apps, customers don't even get the chance to try them before buying them, as you do with clothes or electronics. Lucia Potrisch again.
And we want it to be compulsory for companies to offer demo versions, so that you can see whether an app is useful or not.
But efforts to change or introduce new regulations may fall short. Leon Mollenberg is a senior policy consultant at Twiswinkel, the Dutch Federation for e-commerce retailers.
And it's not on the rules that there is a defective, but it's on the behavior of some big companies, especially parties like Apple in the App Store, and because they think they are an international business. They don't care about national rules. They only act on American-based rules, and they really violate at several points Dutch consumer law.
Mollenberg says that of the 42 million contracts between members of his federation and consumers in 2011, there were only 70 complaints.
It's not a rule, because the rules that give the consumer a right and good protection. The consumer is very well cared of in the new directive for consumer rights, even on the point of digital content. But there are companies which don't comply with these rules. My company is member of our association. They all are compliant to the law because we check them on it.
Apple's terms and conditions state that all sales and rentals of products are final. By agreeing to these terms, Europeans effectively relinquish their rights in EU law, which would normally give them 2 weeks to return a download if they are unhappy with it. That's not to say that EU law is perfect as it stands. Some criticize the fact that all digital products are treated the same way. For instance, with other goods like clothing, you can return a pair of trousers, but you can't return underwear. So, we may need some specific legislation that relates to apps depending on what they do. but Ursula Pachel, Deputy Director General of the European Consumer Organization, is happy with a blanket approach.
From a legal point of view, we don't make any distinction between an application and another digital content that you download from the internet, so that doesn't really matter.
Back in Bad Nauheim, at the State Consumer Protection Ministers' meeting, things ended under a small cloud, despite the consensus amongst lawmakers that apps should be treated like other products, offering a right to return. It was clear that Germans will have to wait months before anything happens.
Verbraucherschutzministerin Frau Aigner.
The Federal Consumer Minister, Ilse Aigner, has made it very clear that it won't be possible to pass a law during this legislative period.
Why? Well, Germany holds national elections this September, and as important as the right to return apps may be, you get the feeling that it's not quite the vote buyer. So, for now, think twice before you buy that app. Cipona Cimbelu, DW, Bad Nauheim.
Well, you would have been hard-pushed to have overlooked the news out of the US last week that researchers have managed to create embryonic human stem cells from cloned human embryos. The researchers at Oregon Health and Science University and the Oregon National Primate Research Center use what's called somatic cell nuclear transfer. That's the same technique used in 1996 to make Dolly the sheep, the first cloned mammal. And their success has been lauded, but it's also been criticized. The technique involves the removal of DNA material from an egg and transplanting genetic material from an adult cell. And Dr. David King of Human Genetics Alert, a secular body, must point out, told me why he's against the research.
By developing this technique, they will make it easy for those who actually want to clone babies and produce a cloned human being to do that, because the main barrier up till now to people doing that has been the fact that it's technically very difficult and there hasn't been a reliable way of doing it. So they've really opened the door for those unscrupulous IVF doctors and so on who want to make money out of human cloning.
There are a couple of points there. I mean, first of all, this is one instance of there having been success in 15 years. So even though they've managed, not everybody is going to be able to replicate what they've done.
True enough. I mean, we don't know to what degree they've really cracked this problem, but they seem to have made a real significant step forward. So, yes, it may not be cloned babies by the end of the year, but that opens up that possibility much more likely now.
Of course, there is also the issue that there will be other labs around the world that will want to try and replicate what has been done in the States. I would suggest that that would also be beneficial, because surely, particularly this type of research has to be reviewed by peers, by other labs around the world, to see whether it is actually there is any truth in the research.
Well, of course, the scientific research always does indeed should be replicated. The other side of this issue is that, you know, we're being told that this is a wonderful medical breakthrough, that it will, you know, potentially cure millions of people disease. In fact, the medical benefits of this whole scenario of therapeutic cloning are highly doubtful. There are a bunch of technical problems, including the fact that any therapy involving embryonic stem cells holds the possibility that those cells will create tumours in the patient.
So it's to create new problems, is that what you're saying?
It will create, it's certainly very potentially risky for patients, but it's also, it will be unbelievably expensive. And the idea that, millions of people are going to be treated by these conditions is extremely unlikely. You would have to make a new cloned embryo and a line of stem cells and develop those stem cells into the tissues that you require for every single patient. And that's just beyond any kind of expense that we have in medical technology today. And there are, lots of extremely expensive medicines about. This will go beyond that. So I'm not convinced by all the promises that are being made. And I think it's really unfortunate that patient groups, get told that this holds the key to, curing their disease, and their hopes get raised. And I think it's really unfair to do.
But surely that is part of the process, that we need to do more research on top of this research to find out whether we can find cures for degenerative diseases. So I'm failing to really see why you have referred to this as being irresponsible, that this research has been published. And you referred also to unscrupulous people who would like to use this purely for cloning humans.
Well, I mean, that's why I use the word irresponsible, because I do think to hand those people on a plate, the technique for doing human cloning is actually irresponsible. People always say, oh, well, if they just do more research, they'll improve the techniques, it'll get cheaper. But there are fundamental biological problems with this whole approach, which it's very difficult to see how it's ever going to be solved. For example, what you do with cloning is you overcome the normal structure of human reproduction, where you have an egg and a sperm coming together. And part of that process is what's called imprinting. That's to say there's a certain markings of the genes from the father and the mother, and if you get that wrong, as you invariably do in cloning, the consequences for the offspring can be extremely severe, as we've seen with a lot of cloned animals. There's no real easy way to see how you get around that.
What of the legal restrictions? I mean, surely it is not that possible. In Germany, for instance, and other European countries, it is not possible to do lots of research. So surely there are legal restrictions that would inhibit people from just running off and doing wild research.
There are in a lot of European countries, that's true. In the United States, there are no legal restrictions on human cloning. And of course, there are many countries around the world. We're very used to medical tourism, to scientists setting up laboratories in countries where there are no restrictions in order to cater to a particular market. One thing we can be really sure is that there will be a significant market for cloned human beings and lots of money to be made there. So it's perfectly possible, and that's why one of the things we've called for is that there really has to be an international enforceable ban on reproductive cloning before this research goes forward.
Dr. David King, Director of Human Genetics Alert there, and you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfi Karabani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum, and you can, of course, always follow us on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. It's taken a reported 14 years and cost $25 million. But with the American Psychiatric Association meeting in San Francisco, it's probably relieved to be launching its long-awaited and snappily titled fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. You'll be happy to know it's also known as the Psychiatrist Bible. But as with the real Bible, the DSM-5 comes with much debate and dispute, with potential ramifications for Europe as well. Some have complained of the ever-swelling number of mental disorders, including hoarding or disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, a designation for children showing persistent foul temper. And there's autism spectrum disorder. In the case of autism spectrum disorder, autism and Asperger's syndrome are now controversially to be combined as one. A number of recent studies are cited as having found that while autism and Asperger's have their variations, the fundamental causes are the same. They're both traced to early developments in the brain. But this is presenting researchers with a new problem. Where exactly does the spectrum start and end? Andre Leslie has this report by Lydia Heller.
When the sun's out, John likes to stay in his room. It irritates him when things glisten and shine. It also irritates him when it's loud, or when there's a kid on the school bus whom he's never seen. John is 12, and he has autism.
He can't write, he can't talk, and he doesn't understand everything. You could say he's like a 2-year-old child.
John was 3 when doctors diagnosed him with early childhood autism. People with early childhood autism fail to develop forms of gesturing or facial expression, and they tend to have problems understanding emotions. Many have compulsive and repetitive rituals and stick to particular ways of doing things and daily routines. Rainer Döhle also has autism. He was an adult when doctors diagnosed him with Asperger's syndrome, a form of autism.
My school reports would always say I had trouble connecting with the rest of the class. I was happy when I was left alone and I was allowed to read. I'm intellectually gifted. I'm interested in geography and history. I sometimes compile incredibly long lists about historical leaders or of capital cities or whatever.
While some autistic people never learn to speak, others are noticed for having a very particular way of expressing themselves. Some lack motor skills, and others can spend hours drawing. There are those who are intellectually impaired and those who have a gift for numbers and memorizing things. But all of them show repetitive, monotonous behavioral patterns and have similar problems interacting socially.
We used to think there were qualitative factors that would explain etiological differences. And there have been numerous studies in the past few years that have shown there is a gradual change in the seriousness of the symptoms. Autism is not qualitatively different from Asperger's syndrome.
Sven Bölte, who was speaking there, is a professor of child and adolescence psychiatric science at the Karolinska Institute's Center for Neurodevelopmental Disorders in Stockholm. He and other autism researchers have recently started to speak of autism spectrum disorders. Its cause, they say, is an atypical but not yet fully understood neuronal development. Brain scans performed on people with autism show less activity in regions of the brain that process emotions and speech. There's more activity in the regions that process objects or recognize systems. Even the docking sites for certain neurotransmitters in the brain, those that regulate fear and motivation, may develop differently. Researchers have found a series of genes and gene mutations linked with autism. But they tend to only explain a few symptoms, such as impaired speech ability. And such symptoms can also be found in healthy people or non-autistic people who have mental retardation, attention deficit syndrome, or epilepsy.
So
there have to be other factors other than genetics. There's a Danish study that looked at viral infections during pregnancy, and it found that the risk of a child being born with autism rose by 2% if the mother had had a viral infection. It could also be complications during birth or environmental toxins. It can all play a role.
This is why psychiatrists and neurologists still tend to diagnose autism based on behavioral patterns, repetitive behavior, problems with social interaction. It's basically a subjective assessment. Inge Kamp-Becker, director of the Child and Adolescent Psychiatric Ward at Marburg University, says the diagnostic line tends to be drawn where a person is unable to execute daily tasks independently, where they need help. But the line can move.
The criteria for what constitutes autism and what is not autism are starting to blur. Where does this spectrum of autism end? If we say a symptom is a characteristic, and as some studies say, that that characteristic also exists in the normal population or with other illnesses, then the situation becomes unclear. So what is it then?
Sven Boelter agrees the lines are blurred. He says the question of whether symptoms are an illness or a character trait in autism is yet to be properly answered.
It's perfectly okay to say that everyone has varying social abilities. And when we see a very low level of social behavior, we can then speak of autism. At the other end of the spectrum, we can say there are those people who are incredibly communicative and social. But I'm not sure, and a lot of my colleagues are unsure, whether there isn't in fact a shift, a qualitative difference. And I've changed my mind 20 or 30 times, because it's so difficult to know.
André Leslie with that report there by Lydia Heller. Now, the German Cancer Research Centre, or DKFZ, says e-cigarettes, electronic cigarettes, are not safe and are currently being used effectively as an uncontrolled experiment on smokers. Electronic cigarettes do not produce the thousands of toxins and carcinogenic substances that standard cigarettes do, and yet they can be highly toxic. Having reviewed most of the data on e-cigarettes, the DKFZ is now calling for them to be reclassified as a medicinal product and that they should be properly regulated too. The DKFZ's Dr. Martina Pötschke-Langer told me how e-cigarettes work and why so many people use them as a means to stop smoking.
The devices consist of a power unit, an electric atomizer, and a replaceable cartridge containing a liquid which is vaporized and inhaled when sucking at the mouthpiece. The main ingredients of the liquids are propylene glycol and or glycerin, flavors also, like, for example, fruit flavors, chocolate flavors, menthol, even Coca-Cola or tobacco flavors and others.
But also some quite carcinogenic substances, as I understand, and formaldehyde.
I would just say the contents of the liquids are these flavors, the propylene glycol and nicotine normally. But we have also nicotine-free liquids. So the problem of this aerosol of some liquids contains harmful substances like formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, acrolein, diethylene glycol or nickel, chromium and lead.
Right.
They have also, we could found also studies that measured the emissions of this vapor, and they found that there are fine and ultra-fine inhalable liquid particles, also nicotine, and cancer-causing substances into the indoor air. I think this is important to know.
While it is a very young product, they are gaining in popularity, aren't they?
This is right. The electronic cigarettes are novel products emerging on the market just a couple of years ago. So consequently, there are only few scientific studies on the health implications of using electronic cigarettes. This must be stated. This is very clear. However, when looking to all these existing published papers, we can state that e-cigarettes cannot be rated as safe at the present time. And consumers do not have reliable information on product quality.
So how has it come about that some consumers may have got the idea that they could use an electronic cigarette in order to help them stop smoking? Where did that come about?
Well, if the product would be safe and the technical problems that does exist at the moment, for example, as leaking cartridges, and also unintended overdose, for example. If these problems would be solved, this product could be a form of nicotine replacement therapy.
Just explain that the overdose, how can you overdose on nicotine? What happens?
Well, when the consumer is smoking too often, and if he is inhaling too deep, and the nicotine content in the liquid is too high, then there could be an overdose of nicotine with all negative effects. And these are really, there are many problematic effects.
Such as?
Such as increased heart rates, increased blood pressure, and also increased risk of thrombosis, increased respiration rate, and also vomiting and problems with mental problems.
It's really the full spectrum there, isn't it? So yes. So what do you want to see happening now to correct this imbalance?
Well, we desperately need to know more on product quality, ingredients, also possible health effects of e-cigarette use, and efficacy of e-cigarettes as cessation aid. We need studies, really good studies by qualified and objective scientists, and then the e-cigarettes should be regulated, especially as medicinal products, regardless of their nicotine content. We know that there are many discussions in blogs, in the internet, that concern smokers. They try to find solutions to get out of this trap.
And they've been trying e-cigarettes as a result.
Yes, and they also report that they cut down smoking the traditional cigarette or quit smoking as a result of using e-cigarettes. So this might be a possible chance, not only of harm reduction, but also of quitting. But this should be done under the regulation of medicinal products.
Dr. Martina Pötschke-Langer of the German Cancer Research Center.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
When Russian Tsar Peter the Great visited the Dutch Republic at the end of the 17th century, the city of Amsterdam inspired him to create his own system of canals in St. Petersburg. Recently, Russian President Vladimir Putin visited the Netherlands. Well, what could have inspired him now? One thing Russia might learn from the Netherlands is that most people want a free and open internet. The internet has long been considered vital for economic and social development. In the Netherlands, about 90% of the country is online. But in Russia, just under half of the population is online, and their movements are probably not entirely free. It's something that struck Peter Teffer in Amsterdam when he met two Russian digital writers who fear censorship is on the rise.
I'm from Russia. My name is Oleg Kashin. I'm a Russian journalist.
My name is Gregory Shvedov. I'm editor of Caucasian Knot. That's 24/7 internet edition, which covers 20 regions of Caucasus.
Oleg Kashin and Gregory Shvedov are keen to spread the word about the internet in Russia. The two journalists say the internet is extremely important there to allow the people to exercise free speech. But it doesn't always work like that. Kashin used to write for the Russian national newspaper Kommersant, but he says the paper's newsroom was not the place to be critical of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I couldn't be a journalist of any Russia's mainstream media because all of them are loyal to Putin. the owners of almost all Russian medias are Putin's friends or state companies or some other, or state or government.
Kashin now publishes online as a freelance journalist and blogger.
Now internet is supporting journalism like air supporting people who breathe. Because without internet, I think Russia used to be like North Korea, because state television is under total control of power. The main newspapers are under total control of power. And only internet and especially social networks now is still space of free speech.
Until recently, it had seemed that in Russia the internet might remain exempt from classic forms of censorship. While the governments of China and Iran actively block pages with politically sensitive material, in Russia there were hardly any restrictions online. The Kremlin, Russia's seat of government, focused more on spreading the official line through state television and newspapers. And Kashin says the Kremlin failed to realize how much the internet was facilitating political activism.
But now, especially after anti-Putin's demonstrations in Moscow in the end of 2011, Putin's team understood that internet is very important for them.
And since then, things have changed. Last November, Russia introduced a new law allowing authorities to block websites that they had placed on a blacklist. The list includes child pornography websites and others offering instructions on drug use and suicide. So you could say there was a positive public interest factor. In one instance, the blacklist authorities ordered YouTube to take down a video which they said promoted suicide. The video features a woman demonstrating how to create the appearance of a slit wrist. Google, which owns YouTube, says the video is meant as entertainment, but it took the video down, knowing that if it didn't, Russian authorities may have made YouTube entirely unavailable in Russia. Editor Gregory Shvedov says it's too early to say whether Russia is in the throes of creating its own great firewall, like in China, but he admits the potential is there.
So far, I don't see a major effect, but it would be instrument which would be used. It's one of many tools which Russian state has to influence, and we need to be aware that it might be used any moment.
Shvedov says laws are like guns that may or may not be fired.
Not all the tools which are ready and lying on a table are used. State of Russia now developed enormous amount of tools to oppress. So far, it's not using even majority of them.
However, Russia does seem to have been inspired by at least one of China's ideas for controlling information in the digital age. Like China's 50-cent army, Russian authorities are thought to be paying internet commentators to write positive messages online about the government.
Kremlin and Putin's team spend a lot of money for supporting users who support Putin in internet discussions. I think it's new generation of propaganda not by television, but propaganda in the social networks and in the internet.
Russian online writer Oleg Kashin, ending that report there by Peter Teffer. And that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. And listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfi Karabani. Our studio tech was Thomas Schmidt. Hope you can make it next time. Till then, thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Change. Nothing's changed.